Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.
Welcome to Friday's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We are glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Later this hour, current sports, Al Martin reports on a new book about Detroit Tigers pitching legend, the late Mark Fidrich. Also later this hour, did you know Michigan State University is one of the few universities in the country that maintains a study abroad program in the country of Mali? This is an African country that for a while was considered the stablest democracy in the continent. It's undergone a great deal of wrenching change in recent years, and we are going to learn more about what's happened in Mali and, as well, more about Michigan State's involvement with its study abroad program in Mali later this hour as well. I think you're going to find it very interesting. At the top of the show today, a much-feared but widely anticipated day arrived yesterday in Michigan's largest city. Officials filed a 16-page bankruptcy petition on behalf of the city of Detroit in U.S. court. With the action, Detroit becomes the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Governor Rick Snyder authorized the filing after efforts by state-appointed emergency manager Kevin Orr failed to satisfy numerous creditors. According to reports, the city owes as many as 100,000 creditors as much as $20 billion. Here to help us understand what's happening and all of its various impacts, reporter John Gallagher of the Detroit Free Press. John, welcome back to Current State.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
And in the studio, we welcome Eric Scorsone, Michigan State University Professor of State and Local Public Finance. Eric, welcome back.
Good morning.
John Gallagher, talk to us about what you've seen and heard since this news broke yesterday, and in particular, what ordinary residents of Detroit are saying.
Yeah, well, everyone, I think, is pretty shocked, even though, as you mentioned, this was viewed as inevitable. And a lot of the business leaders here are saying this is going to be necessary surgery, and, you know, it will right the ship and we'll come out okay on the other end of this at some point. But obviously people are shocked, and anyone who relies on the city of Detroit for a pension or for a health care, all the retirees, municipal retirees, they're very worried about, close to panic, I think, is accurate about what's going to happen to their pensions and health care. And Wall Street people are very upset because they understand they're going to get stiffed on a lot of their investments when they bought Detroit bonds. So there's a range of reaction, but shock and dismay, I think, is probably the good way to put it.
Eric Scorsone, what do you take from the filing? What's on your short list of impacts from this filing yesterday?
Well, first of all, we'll have to see if the municipal bond market raises the cost of borrowing for other Michigan cities and communities. I mean, that's going to be the real question. Does a place like Flint now or Lansing, is it going to cost more to borrow money? Because there's a fear other Michigan municipalities may face the same problems.
Domino effect?
Yeah,
in a way.
Exactly. And that's really the question we'll see over the next few days with the bond markets. I think the other issue is, you know, as John pointed out, for employees and retirees, there's absolutely huge impacts that we won't know for quite a while, but that's going to be a big part of the story as well.
Eric, legally, remind us what a bankruptcy filing does. What changes now?
Well, essentially there's a stay, which means that the city doesn't have to pay anyone and no one can sue them. Now, the city is going to have to prove to the judge they are actually insolvent. And I know that sounds a little bit like, well, aren't they obviously insolvent? But legally, it's a very technical issue about what money does the city have. And this is where things like the DIA come into play, because the creditors are going to argue you can sell the art, you can sell assets, you can raise taxes, you can get the money, you don't need bankruptcy. And this is going to be a very protracted battle because we've seen this in other cities around the country that have filed for bankruptcy.
John Gallagher, what does the filing change for city residents? Let's assume a city resident, there are many of them, I'm sure, who are not former employees of the city necessarily. How does this impact them?
Well, what Kevin Orrin and the governor and everyone else is saying is that it should not have any impact on day-to-day operations in the city, because the city gets to keep its current revenue and apply it to current services as it does now. So, there, you know, the line is that this will be more or less invisible for city workers. However, or I'm sorry, for city residents. The problem, of course, is that services in Detroit are fairly minimal as it is. There's huge amounts of streetlights that don't work. 911 response is spotty. And so on. And so to the extent that we have services now, they'll continue more or less without any change. So the immediate impact should not be apparent in terms of services. It'll be more in things like municipal bond prices.
Eric Scorsone, you alluded to this a minute ago. As far as you know, what kind of legal developments might be happening in the coming weeks and months?
Well, there are going to be a lot of filings from creditors trying to block the city and force them out of bankruptcy because, you know, as you said, they don't want to be here. And so they're going to provide evidence that, well, no, the city has revenues. It can make more reductions in costs. It can raise the income tax back to 3% or something like this, or sell different assets to raise these revenues. And so we'll see a long protracted battle because each creditor may take a different position on this. And there's, as you said, over 100,000. And so I think this is going to be a big part of the story of, you know, from the perspective of a judge, is Detroit truly insolvent? Because if it has to prove that before we can go to the next phase of the trial, which would be the actual plan that would resolve the issue.
John Gallagher, I'm curious, was there a point when you felt emergency manager Orr might get enough concessions from enough creditors that Chapter 9 might be avoided, or have you largely anticipated this?
I think we've anticipated this for weeks, several weeks, and it seemed more than likely when he came on board a couple of months ago. There was always a chance that he might have gotten enough concessions from different people, but I think most of us gave that up some weeks ago, and so it was really a matter of, you know, when and not if.
You suggested a minute ago, John, that Detroit City Services will continue at least roughly along the lines that they have so far. They've been notoriously poor for a long time. Do the people of Detroit anticipate services will take a dip, or are they generally confident that they will at least stay where they are?
Well, I think that you probably get a range of reactions. I think that I'm a resident in the city, and I would expect they'd stay more or less where they are for a bit. You know, there's other things happening, too. We have a new police chief we just hired who is vowing to improve response times and so on. We have a mayoral election this fall, which will have some impact. We don't know what exactly. You know, downtown and midtown are redeveloping pretty rapidly here, which is a positive step. So you've got a lot of things happening at the same time. And the bankruptcy, you know, hopefully, I mean, the long term, hopefully, will be a positive thing to straighten out the city's books. But short term is going to be pretty painful for a lot of people.
John, this is a huge story. Your paper broke. What was it like in the newsroom yesterday leading up to and after breaking the story?
Well, we had inklings over the last couple of days that the bankruptcy filing was going to come as early as Friday, as today. And then, so we posted a story, I think, yesterday around midday saying it was going to happen on Friday. And then suddenly it happened yesterday afternoon, because I think Kevin Orr wanted to get into the courthouse ahead of everybody else, people who were trying to block him from filing. So it was pretty intense. But, you know, we've got a good staff here, and we all hands on deck. And, you know, a lot of people worked pretty late last night.
Which angles of this story will you be paying most attention to here in the short-term future?
Well, my personal beat on the business beat, I'll be looking at all the business reaction and the Wall Street muni prices and, you know, bond prices and trying to get a sense of what this is going to mean for things like, you know, transportation projects, the M1 rail, the Cobo Center expansion, tourism for the city. I mean, all those kinds of, you know, I guess all the economic spinoffs of this.
John Gallagher of the Detroit Free Press, we thank you very much for your time on what I'm sure has been a stimulating time at the Detroit Free Press. We're going to let you get back to work. Good luck. Thank you very much, guys.
Bye-bye.
And Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network joins Eric Scorsone and me now to continue this conversation. Hi, Rick. Thank you for coming in. You were downstairs at WKAR-TV while the governor was giving interviews to all the TV stations.
One floor below where we are right now.
That's right. We're on two. That's the TV station's on one. And you spoke with the governor as well. Where is he on this right now?
Well, obviously, he authorized the bankruptcy filing that he had to. And, you know, as John Gallagher just pointed out, it seemed pretty evident probably weeks ago that we were headed in this direction when the creditors wouldn't agree to, you know, what were really big concessions. And so, as he said, it became a matter of when, not if. And it looks like the state made some decisions, that the state and the emergency manager made some decisions to move quickly before public employee unions could try to do some things to maybe stand in the way of that. Now, going forward on this, you know, obviously, you know, one of the things we've got to find out is where actually the bankruptcy proceedings are going to be held. I think a lot of us are assuming it's going to be in Detroit, but it could actually be in a city in another state even. And you know, maybe the creditors would want to take it there. But wherever it is, other local governments here in Michigan, public employee unions, and legislators are going to be watching what happens in Detroit, because that could very well serve as a template for how other challenged local governments deal with their retiree legacy costs, which would make up the biggest part of Detroit's debt burden.
Eric Scorsone, would you mind responding to that? I'm curious what you make of that.
No, Rick's absolutely right. I mean, whether other cities go into bankruptcy or not, they all face a lot of the same problems on a different scale. But Flint, Lansing, and Grand Rapids, other cities in Michigan have exactly the same issue Detroit has. And I think the question is, you know, are other places, other unions going to say, wow, we better do something because we don't want to end up in this same place? You know, do we make concessions? Do we make changes to pension plans and health care plans so that we don't end up anywhere near this? Because this is going to have implications for every city in Michigan, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're looking at what it might do to municipal credit now that the governor has authorized one bankruptcy. Will the marketplace, and the marketplace is going to do whatever the marketplace is going to do.
That's what Eric pointed out a minute ago. It's going to be very interesting to watch bond rates in the aftermath
of the Detroit fire. You know, the state treasurer, Andy Dillon, says at least they shouldn't, that Detroit is such a unique situation that it shouldn't be held against other communities. But will other communities be held accountable for what's happening in Detroit? You know, as Eric was just mentioning, will public employee unions, having stared death in the face, agree to dismemberment to avoid a similar thing happening to pensions in other places? That this is going to ripple out. And I was talking a few weeks ago to the original sponsor in the legislature of Michigan's emergency manager law, and he thinks that this could serve as a template not for just other communities in Michigan, but we will probably see what happens there play out in courtrooms and legislatures and city halls all across the country.
What is the buzz at the legislature on this? How many legislators have responded explicitly to the Detroit filing so far?
They're politicians. They can't not talk. that we've seen people post about how tragic this is and how sad that it's come to this. One of the things that struck me is actually the absence of finger pointing, that the gaze seems to be resolutely forward and not complaining about these policies or that policies having brought us here. I mean, this is I've been covering Michigan government and politics for 25 years, and this is definitely one of the most serious situations that I've ever witnessed.
Eric, you first mentioned the impact on municipal bond rates in the aftermath of this. Let's go a couple more items down on your short list. What else will you be watching?
Well, I mean, the big issue is the pensions, because Michigan's Constitution protects those, and if a federal judge overrules that, that has implications for every state in this country, essentially, of if even a constitutional protection isn't really sacrosanct, then we see this battle playing out in California right now in Stockton, they're in bankruptcy. And so that means that, you know, even for a lot of other workers around the country, maybe their pensions aren't secure anymore. There was always a perception that, you know, public pension was a, you know, rock solid kind of idea, and that may not be true. And again, other communities in Michigan have underfunded pensions, just like Detroit. So it's not unique. And actually, Chicago was just downgraded big time by Moody's, saying, you know, you have huge legacy costs you're not addressing. And so it's not just, you know, people say this is just Detroit. Detroit's a mess. Everybody knows that. This is Chicago, it's San Francisco, it's New York. They all have the same kinds of problems.
It's such a unique space that one of the reasons that municipal bonds are supposed to be such a good investment is because, you know, unlike a private business, which can't create revenue if it's not making any money, a city typically
always has tax revenue.
Can always raise taxes. Now, what happened in the case of Detroit, and there are certainly, you know, other urban centers in Michigan that are in the same place, is that both legally the city cannot raise taxes. That I know there's this talk about, you know, maybe raising the city income tax. It would require a state law. They would have to get the legislature to approve that, a Republican-controlled legislature to approve a tax increase. They'd have to get the legislature's permission to do that. And also, as a practical matter, you know, so many taxes in Detroit are going uncollected right now, it sort of, you know, begs the question of whether that would have any practical effect.
Very interesting. Right now, we're going to shift gears slightly again. We'll say goodbye and thanks very much to MSU's Eric Scorsone for all your insights today. We appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
And we'll continue our conversation here with Rick Pluta. And we'll change gears here to Medicaid expansion in Common Core. It's been kind of a staycation for the Michigan, for some members at least, of the Michigan legislature.
A few. I mean, right now the Capitol is actually undergoing renovation. If you drive by it, you can see the cranes that House and the Senate chambers have been stripped bare, and we're not seeing a lot of them, you know, hanging out for the summer.
On Wednesday, though, you reported that Republican Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville wants a Medicaid expansion vote in his chamber in late August.
Mm-hmm.
The expansion needs more support from conservatives to survive. What kind of changes do the conservatives want?
Well, basically anything that puts more of this back into the private sector. As a matter of fact, a Tea Party conservative, State Senator Patrick Kolbeck, has not waited for the draft of the Medicaid bill. He's actually sponsoring his own legislation to basically, you know, put more people in Medicaid into private sector health plans, and sort of creating a registry rather than enrolling them. So that's supposed to be kind of a juxtaposition, an alternative to the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. And of course, even in late August is later than the governor wanted it. The House Speaker says that he thinks that there would still be a window to do all the things that you have to get done if it's all finalized in late August, early September. But remember, for this to work, the state has to start enrolling people. The coverage begins in January, but enrollment begins in October. And you've got to, you know, set up all the computer systems, create the software, get approval from the federal government for any waivers that you might need, and anything they do, you know, will require that the time is growing very, very short. As a matter of fact, the state is actually starting to consider delaying the start of the coverage, which matters to Michigan because we don't have to start covering more people on Medicaid on January 1st, but every month that we don't cover them is a month of federal of the federal government paying for it that's lost. That basically that 2 year period where the federal government pays for the whole thing becomes smaller and smaller and smaller.
Okay. The GOP majority House has already passed a Medicaid expansion measure to these Senate holdouts like Senator Kohlbeck. What's wrong with that measure?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, there is a group of people, a group of conservative Republicans that are saying just no cooperation, no enactment of any aspect of the Affordable Care Act, no way, no how, just leave it all in the federal government and let it collapse under its own weight. That's what they're pushing for. And there are groups like Americans for Prosperity that are in there, trying to get them to adopt that. So there are some people who are just never going to take that walk.
Right.
Then there are other people who are saying, we want maybe a few more, free market, quote unquote, reforms in there. We want some more assurances about what might happen if the federal government doesn't grant waivers for, some of the things that we want to do, like after a period of time requiring co-pays or higher co-pays, things like that. And if the federal government just bails on us, then what might happen. So those are the things that the Senate Republicans are looking at. And, one of the things you also have to consider is that part of the political math on this relies on pretty much every Democrat supporting this. Is there a line that you cross where Democrats, at least some of them, start to say,
isn't
worth it?
Supporting the measure, absolutely. Yeah. Let's shift gears to Common Core briefly. Is there a similar dynamic to the Common Core thing?
Mm-hmm.
This is some number of conservative Republicans.
Moderate Republicans and some conservative Republicans for it, and a group of basically Tea Party conservatives who are saying that even though it didn't come directly from the federal government, it is nevertheless nationalized education standards. Yeah. There are certainly parts of Race to the Top that rely on it, and the state should not fold to national education standards. Business groups are very frustrated by this because they like the fact that Michigan students will be compared apples to apples with students in other states as to how they're progressing and how they're learning. And that's basically the value of Common Core.
I've got to ask you about Republican Representative Tom McMillan of Farmington Hills. He gets a lot of coverage for his opposition to Common Core at a House subcommittee hearing on Tuesday. He was overruled by the Republican chair after repeating questions a number of times to, I believe, State Superintendent Flanagan. He roundly criticized Common Core here on Current State a while back. How many others feel like Representative McMillan?
I don't know for sure how many others, once it comes up for a vote on the floor of the State House, but certainly there are others, and this has become just another. It's a now classic confrontation, where you've got the business community on one side of a question, and Republicans are faced between being loyal to their business constituency or to their Tea Party, and that's the choice that they have to make.
Is the opposition to the Common Core standards coming from a lot of the same people who would argue for tougher teacher accountability?
There is
some irony to that.
And what they would say is that Michigan can create its own teacher accountability rather than relying on on a nationalized standard. And of course, this is another one of those odd alliances, because there are also a lot of educators who are frustrated at having to teach to the test.
Okay. Rick Pluta, the Michigan Public Radio Network, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. We'll be back with more Current State. Stay with us. Current State, here on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here today. The West African nation of Mali is well known for its spectacular art and musical traditions, as well as its famed historical city of Timbuktu. And until March of last year, it was also known as the most stable democracy in all of Africa. That image was shattered, however, when a military coup threw the country into chaos, leading to the displacement of nearly a half million people, a surge in Islamic rebel fighters in the north, and an influx of French troops and UN peacekeepers. MSU is one of the few universities in the country that maintains a study abroad program in Mali. The person largely responsible for that is Stephen Esquith. He's the dean of the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, and he joins me now to discuss what's happening in this culturally rich West African country. Welcome to Current State, Stephen.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's start by looking at Mali as a historically significant place in the world. Where is it geographically, and what made it important?
Mm-hmm. Well, you did a nice job leading into this.
Thank you.
And I'll just add a little bit more. If people know anything about Mali, they know Timbuktu.
Yeah.
That's a center of Islamic learning from the 12th, 13th century to the 17th century. Many manuscripts were collected there. Many religious leaders had their home there. It was a kind of mecca for religious scholars and other intellectuals of that period. So Timbuktu was the anchor and really the center of the Malian Empire and the civilizations that grew from that between those over those four centuries. After that, Mali sort of expanded its fame, again drawing on art and culture and many of the sort of fine arts that now we associate with Malian society, its fabric arts, what people know as mud cloth or bogolan, its music, which influenced American blues, and some of its architecture. Those are things that we know, you know, of Mali in its history. It was also a crossroads for many cultures, both north-south and east-west. The east-west trading routes along the Niger River and the north-south trade of salt and other fine arts and products that went from North Africa to South Africa. It's about the size of Texas and California combined. It has perhaps a population of only 14 million or so, and in terms of its economy, it's a struggling economy. As you said, it was a very well-known stable democracy since democratic politics were instituted in 1991, but underneath the surface there were deep problems which have now come to the surface since the coup in March of 2012.
Yeah, that's just a year and a half, or less than a year and a half ago. Briefly, what led to the coup?
Uh-huh. Well, people like to say it was both unexpected and complex, and I think both things are true. What led to the coup was sort of a combination of factors. There was great dissatisfaction among lower-ranking military officers who had been sent to the north to deal with some of the conflicts that were beginning to bubble up. They didn't have the supplies. They didn't have the support that they needed. There was a growing dissatisfaction among ethnic groups in the north, often referred to as the Tuareg, who felt that since 1991 they really hadn't benefited in the same way that other groups in Mali had benefited. There was a group of Malians who had worked in Libya, and after the coup in Libya returned to Mali, unemployed but well-armed, and throwing their support to the northern separatists, the Tuaregs, created a potent combination of dissatisfaction. Add to that greater interest by Al-Qaeda and other radical Islamist groups in the region who saw the vacuum, the political vacuum, and the military weakness in northern Mali as an opportunity to establish a stronghold, increase their revenues through narcotics trading and arms trading in the north. With all of that happening, the French looked across the Mediterranean and said, this is not a healthy situation for Western Europe and for French interests, and we think we need to do something, and the UN needs to do something.
And they have since settled down this mm-hmm. rather unstable situation.
Yeah, I think that's true. Settled down is a good way to describe it. It's not over. there still are many folks dissatisfied in the north, and French and Belgian and other UN peacekeeping troops are still there holding sort of things together, but we're not out of the woods, if we can use that metaphor in a mostly desert climate. We're not out of the woods quite yet. But things are moving in the right direction. And
an election is coming up.
And an election, very good. An election is coming up. July 28th is the scheduled election, and that'll be the first round. And Mali, like many countries, if there's no majority winner in the election, this is a presidential election, there would be a second runoff election in August around the 11th. But the election is not something that everybody thinks Mali is technically prepared for. They have to issue identification cards to many people who haven't had them. In the last two elections, there was some dissatisfaction. And Mali, unfortunately, is well known for its low voter turnout. And low voter turnout in this election might cast some doubt about the legitimacy of the elected government.
So it's unclear whether an election will lead to greater reconciliation or not?
Yeah, perfect question. And so the interim government right now has tried to put together, at the same time that they're organizing for the election, something that they call the National Commission for Dialogue and Reconciliation. Mali has a history of being a country in which dialogue and conversation and sort of collegial relationships between ethnic groups has generally held true, and they would like to see a reconciliation process occur, but they know they have to build it from the ground up. It can't simply be established as a national board that holds hearings and announces, you know, amnesty for certain groups. There has to be a longer process of discussion, conversation in regional dialogue forums. So they're moving to institute not just a national commission, but regional and local, at the commune level, it's called in Mali, conversations to deal with grievances and concerns about what crimes were committed during and after the coup.
Talk to us about Michigan State's activities in Mali then. How has all of this instability impacted student exchanges?
Good. Michigan State has been in Mali for 30 years now. The primary focus of the Michigan State efforts in Mali has been in the area of food security. So the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources has been working closely with USAID and Malian partners to help institute reforms within agriculture. In addition, Michigan State's been involved in a project called the Afrobarometer, which through the Political Science Department here. So those are long-standing commitments, and they continue in Mali and have continued even through this period of instability.
They have?
Yeah.
Okay.
My own work, as you mentioned early on, has been through a study abroad program, which we created in 2004 in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. And we traveled to Mali four or five times during that time, taking about 20 students, working on civic engagement projects in Mali, in the arts and in education. In 2012, we had 17 students ready to go. We were about to purchase their visas, and we had to postpone the project because of the coup. I just returned from a trip to Mali after being away for a year, and I'm encouraged. I think we'll be back. The elections, of course, have to happen, but we're going back.
You bring Mali to Michigan State, though, as well. We do more than just send students to Mali.
Correct.
It works in reverse as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, correct. We've had several exchange programs with Malian students and intellectuals who've been in the residential college over the last 4 years, religious leaders, as well as artists and academics. We've had artists in residence, mudcloth artists, musicians, rappers, photographers. The richness of Malian culture continues to affect Michigan State through these exchange programs, and that's another part of the project that we want to reinvigorate, and we have Malian partners who are eager to host our students and our faculty and to share their traditions with us here.
Stephen Esquith is the dean of Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. His work and teaching focus on the West African nation of Mali. Thanks for joining us today, Stephen.
My pleasure.
The year is 1976. Gerald Ford is president. Our nation comes together for a bicentennial party and after a prolonged and divisive war in Vietnam. A film called Rocky leads the movie box office and Silver's Boogie Fever tops the music charts. The Detroit Tigers are heading for a fifth place finish in the American League's Eastern Division. They also have baseball's biggest star. Pitcher Mark Fidrich took baseball and the sports world by storm in 1976. A new book by lifelong Tiger fan Doug Wilson remembers Fidrich, who died in 2009. And WKAR's Al Martin recently spoke with Wilson about his bio, The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. The conversation starts with Wilson remembering Fidrich's early appearances.
Well, he came up, he was kind of an unknown to most media and fans. You could do that back in those days. They didn't have all the internet and things to track people. But he had had a very good year in the minors the year before. But he was a non-roster pitcher in spring training in 76. He made the team. Hawk pitched him in relief a couple times to let him get his feet wet. And he didn't make his first start till about the middle of May. Mm-hmm. But when he took the mound against the Indians in Detroit, he threw a two-hitter, won the game 2-1, and the guys in the other dugouts, the guys in the press box started noticing that not only was he winning games, he was doing some pretty strange things out on the field.
We watch you tonight, patting the mound, talking to the ball, it looks like, or talking about location. Is that what you're doing out there?
Well, when I pat the mound, I'm just keeping it so I don't, you know, get in that guy's road. I want to dig my own hole and my own landing point and all that, because I have my own thing, and then I'm just getting myself psyched, telling them, don't let up now. Just throw it as hard as you can, as hard as you can. And if they burn you, they burn you. That's, you know, life. But I got luck. I lucked out tonight, and I had the great D behind me in the runs, too.
I tell you, you didn't.
And over the next month, it just gradually built up. More people were coming out.
Now, Doug, I read that Mark was just such a popular player that opposing teams would sometimes even ask the Tigers if he would pitch on a certain day while on the road, just to attract people. I mean, certainly a cultural figure. I mean, even the first athlete to grace the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, talk about his impact culturally.
Well, like you said, after halfway through the season, almost every game he pitched, there were 40 to 50,000 fans, home and on the road. He single-handedly outdrew four other teams for the season just in his 29 starts. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the general managers knew if the Bird made an appearance in their park, that was a sellout that night. And so they wanted them to juggle the lineup. But, you know, everywhere he went, the fans were there. People were in the airport, grocery stores, hanging around his apartment. But he really loved it. He was just a guy who enjoyed connecting with people. And the fans could see that. And that's what kept making them come back.
Right, definitely. Now, Doug, what was Mark's lifestyle like away from baseball?
Well, he was pretty famously casual. He was from a real small town in Massachusetts, and after his first big game, People Magazine sent a reporter over to his apartment, and you know, they reported to the country he had sheets hanging on the windows instead of curtains. He was sleeping on a mattress on the floor, didn't have a bed. Didn't have a telephone, didn't have a TV. He told the reporter, he said, yeah, I'm usually clean, but every now and then I let my dishes stack up, but they don't get too high because I only have four. And so he was happy just living a simple lifestyle. And you know, he was making the major league minimum, $16,000 a year, which is pretty unbelievable nowadays looking at the salaries. But the reporter's asking me, you know, you're drawing $500,000 every game. You should be getting more money. And he told me, what do I want more money for? 2 years ago, I was making $2 an hour at a gas station. This is more than I ever had.
Wow.
And you know, he was happy with that. He didn't get an agent. He negotiated his contract by himself. And, you know, he was loyal to the Tigers. And, you know, fans ate that up. That was what they wanted to hear at the time.
We're talking with Doug Wilson. He has a new book highlighting Mark Fidrich's life. Fidrich was, of course, a Detroit Tigers pitching legend back in the day. They nicknamed him the Bird. Doug's book is called The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. So, Doug, now Mark was injured. He injured his knee in 1977, an injury that he worked through, but it was when he injured his rotator cuff that really hindered his career. When he got his shoulder repaired, did he ever talk about returning back to the game?
Well, you know, one of the frustrating things was when he hurt his arm, that was before the days of MRIs and things like that, so they didn't really know he had a torn rotator cuff, and so he tried for about 5 years to come back. You know, he tried everything, all kinds of hokey diets, medicine, hypnotism, but after he had finally retired, about 2 years later, he went down to Dr. James Andrews, and by then they could do arthroscopic surgery, and they found the rotator cuff and fixed it, but by then he had been out of baseball 3 years. He was 33, and you know, his life had moved on, and so it was too late.
So what was life for him like after baseball?
I was actually pretty good. Again, when he was a young kid on top of the world, he had always told reporters he liked trucks, he liked fiddling with engines, and he wanted to be a farmer. Of course, they thought, you know, that's just more evidence of him being a nut. But when he got out, that's exactly what he did. He had saved some of his money. He bought some nice land in the small town that he lived in, raised pigs. He got a big dump truck, and he was basically a blue-collar worker. Get up at 5 in the morning, go haul asphalt and gravel all day, come home, work the pigs. And he was happy.
Wow.
He loved it. He married a girl from his high school, had a daughter, and you know, and he spent a lot of time doing charity work. He was always happy to put on his Tigers hat, get out and meet people, and he never really expressed any bitterness for his injury or what happened.
Now, for you, Doug, when looking at Mark's life and putting together this book of yours, what do you think for you is the most fascinating part of his life when you were going through the process of putting this book together?
Well, again, that whole attitude of not being bitter. You know, if you look at it one way, he missed the free agent era, and by 2 years, he would have made millions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he missed the diagnosis and being able to fix his arm by 2 to 3 years. If they had fixed it, he could have had a 15, 20-year career. But, you know, he never looked back and felt bad about that. He always just told everybody he was happy for what he had and happy for what it got him. But, you know, the other surprising thing is you talk to people now, it's hard to explain the phenomena of being in a ballpark when he was there because there's nothing to compare it to.
Right.
You know, people talk about Lynn Sanity a few years ago, and, you know, I just say he made Lynn Sanity look like a church bingo party. I mean, you had 50,000 people just on their feet screaming nonstop the whole game.
I've seen a lot of ball games played, and I've caught a few. I don't think I've ever seen a pitcher this keyed up in the ninth inning of a ball game or all through the ball game. You'd think this guy'd be running out of gas by an hour, starting to get down a little bit. But he is just starting to heat it up.
What's getting me is he's giving me duck bumps, and I've watched over 8,000 ball games.
The fans are cheering, "Let's go, Mark." And now, the 3-2 to Hendricks. The fans ready to explode. Here's your pitch. Ground ball should be the ball game. It's over. And the Tigers act like Fidrich has just won the seventh game of the World Series.
He has. He's won seven in a row. He is some kind of unbelievable young Mark Fidrich.
So Mark Fidrich thanking his teammates. Look at that. He's thanking his teammates.
Every single game when he finished, they called him back out. You know, in a midseason game for a fifth-place team, they called him out for curtain calls every single game.
The fans are calling for him to come back. So Mark Fidrich, possibly the all-star pitcher with a record of 8-1. Eight complete games stops the Yankees' winning streak at 5.
Wow.
And, you know, there's nothing to compare to because there hasn't been anything like that since.
Even Lin, I remember when Lin Sanity was taken off, man. I mean, everybody was talking about Jeremy Lin. You say that made a church bingo party is what you compared it to.
Yeah, you know, everybody say it was just a massive two-hour party every single time he took the mound.
21-year-old Mark Bigridge from Worcester, Mass. And here he comes. Here he comes.
Oh, this is unbelievable.
He loves him. Look at that. Shaking the policeman's hand. Look at that. This kid is terrific.
I, in my life, I've been in baseball 35 years. I have never in my life ever seen anything to equal this. The closest
he's
was when
crying.
Dale Long hit a home run. Why wouldn't he cry?
He's look so happy. He's look at this.
Wow. And like I said, I wish I had a time machine to go back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Doug Wilson. He has a new book highlighting Mark Fidrich's life. Mark Fidrich is a legendary Tigers pitcher back in the late 70s. Doug has a new book out highlighting Mark's life entitled The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. So what do you think Mark's legacy is, Doug?
Again, a couple things. One is a guy who came along when baseball really needed it, because the game was flagging, the game was dropping in popularity. He came along and made the game fun. He just enjoyed it. And then also a guy who gave back to his community, who was always willing to do charity, who always had a positive attitude after he got out of the game. And that's something that, you know, a lot of modern players could look at that as a role of how to be remembered.
Doug Wilson, author of The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. Go pick it up. Doug, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, well, thanks for having me.
And as memorable as 1976 was for Detroit Tigers fans, 2013 isn't a half-bad season for the Tigers as well. We'll point out here as we head into the hot, long, hot weekend, the Tigers return from the All-Star break tonight to face the Royals in Kansas City. Nice part of the country to be in when it's really, really warm, you know, Kansas City. Anibal Sanchez is scheduled to start for Detroit, while the Royals are expected to send Irvin Santana to the mound. Detroit leads the American League Central by 1.5 games over the Cleveland Indians, so we're in a little bit better shape in 2013 than we were in 1976. Mark Fidrich aside. Coming up tomorrow on Current State Weekend, the Broad Art Museum is opening its first exhibition featuring a Michigan artist. Learn more about the exhibit Less Still this weekend. Also, the local folk group The Barred Owls will discuss their upcoming album with host Emmanuel Berry, and we have some music from The Barred Owls to take us out today. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and to Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.